Hi, this is Jen. Thanks for tuning in to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For those who are new or returning listeners, you may know that you can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. Today's episode is what I call a mashup, and I've been calling it the debut episode. That's been in the works for a couple months now, actually. I had the thought of talking to different debut artists who have gone about publication in different ways, not necessarily the traditional route or the traditional route, and definitely wanted to keep in line with the goal of Minorities in Publishing of talking to marginalized voices. That in mind, I spoke to three separate artists, and we spoke via Skype, we spoke in person, and via phone. So I want to give a big thanks to MR Daniel for helping to smooth out the sound levels on that point. And in their discussions, I really wanted to talk about what their experiences were as debuts, what you, for I know many listeners are artists, aspiring, emerging, however you want to phrase it, but you are artists and writers and visual artists as well. And I wanted to talk about what the realistic expectations were, the hardships, the realities, just to give you an idea of what it's like, not just as someone who is considered marginalized or writing about marginalized communities, but also in terms of being a debut and what that means. So I really want to thank Sophia Chester, Leland Chuck, and Mira Jacob for all taking the time to talk to me. And we had fantastic discussions. I thought there would be 20 minutes tops. We all ended up talking for about an hour each interview. So it was really fun listening to them, kind of breaking them down, chopping them up a little bit, and trying to post in digestible chunks to see what's helpful. But really, all of it is fantastic conversation. I really hope everyone finds it helpful. And I really hope everyone enjoys this conversation and that it contributes to some inspiration and just follow through and a better understanding of the industry if you don't know what it's like to be in it or to try to get in it. I know it can be very frustrating as an artist, and I want to give you a hope of the light at the tunnel. So just to give a quick rundown, Sophia Chester is the creator of Cosmic Callisto Caprica, and she is the self-published representative in this case. Leland Chuck wrote The Misadventures of Sullivan Pong, and he is the indie representative. And Mira Jacob, author of The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing and an upcoming graphic novel memoir, is the Big Five rep. So thanks again for tuning in, and hope you find this episode helpful, and feel free to follow each of them. I'll note what their handles are at the end of their segments. So first up is Sophia Chester, author of Cosmic Callisto Caprica, which she ran a Kickstarter for last year to try to fund. So here's our conversation. You chose to do the self-pub route rather than the traditional route. So when you mean all these balls in the air, I guess, you're thinking of yourself as editor, content creator, publisher, marketer, publicist. And design director, because you're commissioning the art.
Yes, yes. That was one of the most important things, because I know that when people, like, you know, they think of things that are independently published, they think that it's going to be lackluster. And, you know, and it's just, it's so hard, you know, because you have to pick and choose. If you don't have the money, like, what do I invest in? Do I invest into my editing, or do I not invest as much into graphic art? And unfortunately, you know, it's just, that's just the world we live in. You know, people do judge a book by its cover, and you can have, like, a really gorgeous story, but if you have a crummy looking cover, no one's gonna pay attention.
With that in mind, why did you choose to go the self-pub route rather than the, let's use quotation marks, traditional route? Because of all this work that's involved, and it's a lot. Like, you know, it's a lot.
It is a lot. If I don't have some sort of, like, existential crisis at least once a week where, like, I'm curled up, you know, in a fetal position, then
you're not doing your job.
I'm not doing it right. So, but I remember after I did my Kickstarter and things didn't go well with that, Lee and Lowe Books, they were doing like a science fiction like book contest, and
it's either the New Visions or the New Voices.
So I did that, and I sent my, I think they want the first, I can't remember how much they wanted, but I sent a portion of my manuscript in, and I remember sitting on Twitter and like looking at their Twitter, someone who, whoever manages it, was talking about their slush pile and having to go through, you know, all these stories and manuscripts that were sent in. And I remember just kind of sitting there and just thinking, like, somewhere in that office in New York is my manuscript, and it is sitting on top or in the middle or at the bottom of some slush pile, and someone's going to read it. And there's a good chance that they may be exhausted. Maybe they care. Maybe they don't care. Maybe they can't see how special my story is. And I'm like, I can't do this. I can't keep sending, you know, I can't like send my story in and hope and hope that I can like beat the millions and millions and millions and millions of manuscripts that are sent in, and the hopes that I can get my story out there. What if I get past the first two people, but someone decides, oh, no, I don't like this. I don't like science fiction. I don't like the subjects. I don't like what's being told in this story. So, nope, back to square one for you. And I was like, you know what? I'm not. I'm just going to eliminate that. And I'm just going to do it myself.
Mm-hmm. And do you also feel like that concern about how it's going to be ingested, so to speak, is part of the biases that are in publishing? And I'm going to be quite open that I feel that there are biases. And, yeah. I feel that there's systemic issues, but I also feel like there are biases because of how we've been taught to read.
Looking over everything.
Yeah. So, but do you really think it's the biases of publishing, or, you know, the perceived biases for some of, well, people don't want these stories of marginalized characters, or they might like it better if it wasn't a marginalized characters? And Lee and Lowe does specifically go for multicultural content.
Yeah, they're really good about that. I checked out their directory. It's very diverse. But I feel like the whole it won't sell because said character is Black. And I'm like, okay, well, what's your reason? Mm-hmm. Other than the fact that that's just been the status quo for years upon years. I'm like, show me the math. Show me the statistics.
So let's talk about Cosmic Callisto Caprica. Who is Cosmic Callisto Caprica? What is this world?
Well, my main character, Cosmic Callisto Caprica, her friends call her Cosmo for short.
I call it the three C's, as I was telling Sophia before we started recording.
She lives in this very unique world where it's very retro futuristic. It's basically like the 1950s, but in space. So there's like flying saucers, and people live on colonies. And Cosmo goes to this school. It's run by her government. The name of their government, it's called the Lunar Federation. The moon is like the center of everything. It's the center of the government. Their laws are made there. Like, that's where everything happened. Everything happened on the moon. And the school that she goes to, it's very expensive. There's lots of other schools that you can attend and go to, but like the Lunar Federation Academy is elite. That's the one you want to go to, because you can end up having a job working for the government. Who wouldn't want to do that? And what Cosmo's studying so that she can be a detective and eventually work for the government system that, you know, runs everything in their world. And also, there are Martians. And one of Cosmo's best friends is a Martian, and her name is Martha.
And she goes to the Federation as well?
Yes, and she's the only Martian in her entire class. And there are these rules in this world. One of the rules is it's divided yet one. And this law states that everything must be separated for humans and for Martians. Humans have their own places where they live, and Martians have their own place where they live. And this law, divided yet one, it's basically they're saying that, you know, even though everyone's divided, we're still one person, you know, everyone's still living together, quote unquote, in harmony, even though things are separated, not fair for Martians.
Oh, that's quite the metaphor.
Yeah. I was like, if I'm going to have 1950s in space, I have to address that in some sort of way.
So it's like an alien Jim Crow.
Yeah, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Coswell, she just wants to be a detective. She just wants to explore. She's very inquisitive. And basically, the series is just going to be about her dealing with these social issues with Martians, but also solving mysteries and just having fun with her friends.
So is this a graphic novel or a comic?
It's a novel. It's going to be an ebook, but I'm also going to have like illustrations in there.
Oh, I see. Because I saw it on Superheroes in Color and they do primarily graphic novels and comics. I thought it was specifically a graphic novel.
That's fun. That's a common, that's something that I have to work on to get my points across, that it's a novel, it's an ebook,
there will be illustrations.
There will be illustrations to help get the point across, because for one thing, as we all know with YA novels, you are white until presumed otherwise.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So no, I'm gonna have illustrations in there so that you can see
mm-hmm.
who, you know, what people look like, and to not make any assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the kind of assumptions that people made with The Hunger Games and Rue, even though it's clearly obvious.
Yeah. In creating Cosmic Callisto Caprica, Cosmo for short, as a writer, what kind of feedback were you getting from it? I mean, as you were creating it, do you have a community where you are? Is it mainly an online community? And you said to me when we were emailing that you also got good feedback and you felt better about your crowdfunding by the responses that you got.
My community, it's definitely, for right now, it's definitely online. I'm kind of proud of myself. I have a somewhat really good Tumblr blog. Like the people who follow me, they're very responsive, and it's just, I feel like crowdfunding and stuff like that, like that's the way to go. That's how we're going to achieve diversity with books and with comic books and stuff like that, because, you know, we don't have to deal with sending, you know, your stuff in. You can just crowdfund it yourself.
Yeah.
And I've gotten nothing but positive feedback, because people are hungry. They're hungry for stories that are different. And I mean, just everybody. I feel like everybody. I've gotten, positive feedback from Black people, positive feedback from White people, just positive feedback all around, because people are just sick and tired of these same old stories.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what did you learn from the crowdfunding experience? I thought it was very interesting when you told me you were crowdfunding at the same time as that sandwich guy. Which,
yep,
I didn't even realize at the time. I heard about that guy. I wrote him off. I said, that's horrible. But if people wanted to spend their money like that, fine. But in looking at it and saying, okay, someone, an artist, is trying to create work that where people can see themselves and obviously has a plan together versus this kind of hokey, this is a joke, but he actually got that money. You know,
yeah.
I highly doubt he said, okay, guys, joke, take your money back.
Yeah.
I'd have to do research on that, and I can afterwards, but I highly doubt he did.
Last time I checked, and this was like during my campaign, and I remember just like sitting at my laptop, and I don't know mentally where I was. Like, I just could not believe that, like, this guy was gonna get $60,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I'm sitting here, I'm like, I'm trying to kickstart my book,
mm-hmm.
and it's diverse, and it has girls in it, and it's in space, and it's a lot of fun. And
and a guy who's eating a sandwich. Yeah.
So it wasn't a sandwich, it was potato salad.
Oh. Okay.
It was potato salad. He wanted to make a fake Kickstarter so that he could like make potato salad. And some of the rewards was like, you can get a picture of me eating potato salad. And
yeah.
Yeah, but crowdfunding is very fickle.
Yeah.
That's That's just the best way. That's the best way I can describe it. It's not 100% guaranteed because you can put everything you're all into it. You can be you know, incredibly organized and have like you know, really good gifts. You know, you can have like a really snazzy and good looking pitch video, and you can still fail. And I remember like before I decided to launch my Kickstarter, and then afterwards, you know, so because I was trying to learn from my mistakes, like I'm looking at some of these projects, and some of these people, you know, they live in these big metropolitan cities, and just they've got stretch goals, and just everything. I mean, they just look so incredibly organized, and some of these projects still failed. And then it's like on the other hand, it's like I would look at some of these other projects and people with 10-minute pitch videos,
Whoa, 10 minutes?
10-minute
That's
pitch videos.
long. That's way too long.
It was this chick, and I think she was like trying to like publish her poetry. And I'm like, honey, why do you have a 10-minute pitch video? I would really like to see the statistics, 'cause like I was looking at my statistics for mine with my pitch video, because my pitch video for my Kickstarter was like, I think it was 2 minutes long, and like 60% of the time people were watching it all the way through.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, there's some projects like that lady with the 10-minute pitch video and not offering any real gifts, just like, oh, you'll get my gratitude, or your name's in the book, or I'll send you a virtual hug, and they get all their money. You know? The best piece of advice I can give is like, it's not with crowdfunding, it's not guaranteed. It's not, you may get none of your money, just barely enough, or you might get a lot. You know, it's just do your research, you know, figure out a good time to launch your campaign. Like, you know, don't do anything silly. Like, you don't want to launch like during the holiday season, because who's going to want to donate if, you know, they're busy trying to figure out how they're going to buy gifts for their family or whatever. Try it, you know. And oh my God, I have put so much into this. I mean, it would be nice if, you know, if it could turn into like a second income for me, because I can't see myself like putting the amount of time and the amount, like even some of my own personal money. Like, there's some things in regards to Cosmic Callisto Caprica where like I'm using my own money and I'm using my own funds,
Yes.
and it's
And to make it look professional, it's expensive.
yeah.
I mean, if you
Oh,
wanted
it's
it to look like
very.
crap, you could have been done already.
There's some things that I'm kind of like working, that I'm kind of working on like right now. Like, one of them is well, here's one thing that I worked on. I recently just had someone, and I use my own money. I recently just paid someone to redo my Tumblr blog, because I was just using one of their free layouts, and I was like, you know, I need something to look more professional. I need people to have access to my social media information. And it all costs so much.
Yeah, I have to redesign my website this year, and I'm saving my pennies for it, 'cause it's in the thousands. It's in the thousands. And that's even not if you want all the bells and whistles of Java.
Yep.
So, I mean,
That was my problem. I was constantly having to like reblog my social media information so that people can, you know, find it. But now I don't have to, because thank God I've got these widgets at the top of my page, and people can like easily find my other websites.
Yeah. So what's your next move to have Cosmo's story to be seen? And what do you think the industry needs to do to make more voices like yours and Cosmo's feel like they matter to the creation of content? 'Cause I want to read this story. I want to see it in print and in fruition.
I can literally lay down on my belly and like stretch out, and I can touch the finish line. Like, right now, my manuscript is back in my hands, and I'm just going over everything. I'm making sure that everything that I've written down and everything that I've said, about this world that I've created is exactly what I want it to be. And I'm trying to keep up with my personal deadline. I would like to, at least, and it's very possible, sometime during the first week of February, I would like to return it back to my copy editor. And then my copy editor, you know, she'll go over it, fix anything that needs to be corrected. We'll probably, you know, correspond through email like we've been doing. And then that's it. I have my first editor that I work with, my developmental editor. She's going to format it for me. And then it's publishing time.
So you're still going to pursue self-publishing?
I'm still going to pursue self-publishing. I know that Kindle, Amazon, they have like a really nice program where you can put your books up for sale and people can buy them, you know, in a book format. I'm going to try and do that as well, because I would, I'm going to see how much it costs. I would like to have physical copies of my book to send to libraries and stuff like that.
Oh, absolutely. That's imperative.
Yeah, I really want to be able to do that. I'm not entirely sure yet if I'm ready, because publishing, like printing your own book, that's crazy expensive.
It is.
And it is. And I don't have the money to print them and, you know, to be able to set something up where people can buy physical copies. I mean, for right now, I would probably, if I were to print them, it would be for like my own personal needs, like for friends or for family, or like I said, to, you know, send to libraries and stuff like that. But I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing right now. I have an online audience and I'm going to use that to the fullest. And I'm just going to, you know, keep trying to get the word out there about my book and my characters, because I think what I have is something that's, you know, very, very special. And I really hope, it's like always my biggest prayer, that there will be some like little girl out there who will read it and will see like, look, there's someone on the cover who looks just like me. And that'll, you know, it'll maybe inspire her to love herself more. And to see that, yeah, you can be the star of the story. And not the sassy girlfriend, not the sassy best friend, or, you know, you can save the world. You can do it.
And next, I spoke with Leland Chuck, who wrote The Misadventures of Sulliver Pong, which was published by the Chicago Center for Literature and Photography, and it came out last year. What I was really interested in, and in talking to other people, I spoke to Mira earlier today, as you know, and she had mentioned that she had not gotten anything published, not a short story or anything like that. She did a reading series, the Pete's reading,
right.
But she didn't have anything published, and she got a book deal.
Yeah.
And on your end, you have a lot of accolades, publications in well-known lit mags, smaller known lit mags, a numerous amount, as right. well as getting into residencies, especially McDowell is the creme de la creme.
Oh, that was amazing. Very lucky. Yeah, I didn't really even know like what McDowell was about. It was my MFA mentors suggested that I apply, Lori Foose and Michael Lowenthal. And then I had a friend that had just been there, so I had him write the recommendation. He's like, oh, you should really go to McDowell. I didn't really even know like what a big deal it was until I got there. And then it's like, I'm the only unpublished writer there, and there are like seven writers, and it's Michael Chabon, you know, you know, Heidi Julowitz, Sam Lipsight is there, and I'm just like, what am I doing here? So like there's a point where you have, where people read their work or like share their work.
Yeah.
I was like super nervous. I remember that.
Oh, did you read from Sulliver?
Yes. Yes.
So with all that going on, how was the process for you in terms of, did you pursue an agent? Did you get found because of your publications? Was it pretty easy? Were you sending out queries constantly? Or?
Yeah, no. I mean, I've never been approached by an agent. I've always been querying. I've been querying seemingly for like 20 years. And I did have an agent shortly after McDowell. A couple of agents were interested in Pong. And
had they heard about it via McDowell or no?
No, cold query. And I picked one, and the book didn't sell. So, you know, never really understood why you can't take a book that's been shopped to another agent. And, you know, usually agents just kind of like, if it's been shopped, it's like over, you know. They don't want to look at the book.
were they at least interested in this particular agent ask you, okay, so what's the next book? That's what it sounded
yes.
like.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Like, ready for the next book. But obviously, novels take like 5 years for me to write usually. I'd like to say that I could churn them out quicker. And usually there's a point in the novel writing process where mm-hmm. you think like, oh, this is going to be a lot faster. I'm going to crank this out in 2 years. And that's like right. when you know you're like, you should hold back. Because if you query, then you're probably going to get rejected, you know, in mass.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been a struggle. Like the whole time, 20 years, it's been almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's been 16, 17 years since I started writing. And it never gets easier. It's almost like you feel like there are very few connections between, you know, you and the actual publishing world.
Yeah.
It feels like you're outside the gates.
Well, in terms of your knowledge of publishing, because like in the essay we're going to talk about, you're solitary. It is a solitary practice in itself. Right. So how much did you know? I mean, obviously you were querying.
Yep.
Did you get the Writer's Digest Literary Market?
Yeah.
Were you doing all those kind of like research, make sure.
Yeah, you do all the, how do you start out as a writer, you know, and you need an agent obviously to get into the big five. And so you do that. And that was probably, you know, the beginning. I was probably in my early 20s. I'm in my late 30s now. So the game hasn't really changed.
Mm-hmm.
Except you used to send letters. You used to send paper.
You save on postage.
Right. And what I have noticed is actually that agents are consistently less respectful of writers. They don't even write back now.
And they'll announce that on their site. It's like, if you do not hear from me in 6 weeks, assume I don't want it.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, right now I'm unagented, and I just figure that, you know, when I'm ready for another agent, it'll happen, and we'll go from there. But, you know, it's great to have a book out. That's the ultimate goal, right? And it's something I talk about in that essay I sent you. It's easy to forget in all the struggles and the rejections that, you know, this is like a dream, to actually be able to publish a physical book. And whether it comes from a big five or an indie publisher, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. So you applied, or they had an open call, a submission, because you said you gave percentages, which is always really helpful.
Right.
And also kind of, it could be a deterrent for some. It's like, well, if it's only this percent. But you said in your essay, out of 500, what was it, 10? I believe it was 10, because it came to 2%.
Right.
And yours was one of
the
10
right.
out of a slush pile
of
500.
Right. Right. But if you think about it, if you're submitting for awards, it's probably the same type of
percent.
Number.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, and for this novel, I'd been sending out that manuscript for awards and stuff, and it'd been placing, so I had a sense that it was coming out of the slush well, that it was complete, you know, as a package. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a residency in 2012 and just said, I'm going to reread this and see if my instincts are correct, that the book is publishable. And I was like, this is great. Of course, I think it's great, but, it's like, it's a little bit like, what I imagine, having a child would be like, it's like,
me too. I'd imagine that.
Yeah.
I don't have kids, but I imagine.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Aw, it's here.
Exactly. it's that experience of, when you're writing it and when it's in manuscript form and you feel like it's getting close, you feel like maybe one day, my baby will be president, that type of thing. But when it's out there and you're like, I'm perfectly happy with it being out there and being read by strangers and people responding to it.
So what was the process in terms of working with Chicago? Because you said earlier that you had more control, which is not something that can be said a lot. I mean, if you're an author with clout, you're pretty much running the place.
You know,
if you're Toni Morrison, no one's saying no to you.
Right.
But that takes a long
time
to do. And for people of color, you may not even ascend to that level anyways.
Yeah.
So in the indie process, how was it so collaborative?
It's just there are fewer cooks in the kitchen. It's basically you and the editor, of Clap, Jason Pettis. We just went through a couple of rounds of, of joint editing, and you know, he would go through and he would go through the manuscript with his marks. I would go through the manuscript with my marks. He would go through again, and then I did it again. So, you know, I got to see every part of the process. I even wrote the book flap. I mean,
he gave me that option. Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, it's pretty powerful to be able to say that, you know, to have a book out that you had a hand in, like, everything.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Which is kind of the indie process. I would imagine it's similar to what, like, indie filmmaking is like, you know, where you don't have to deal with a lot of studio people. You know,
yeah.
And, you know, I'm a pretty active book reviewer, and I will say that, you know, I love books by Big Five presses, but, you know, just as much as I love books from indie presses, but, you know, in recent years I have noticed that the books feel like they're buffed. It's they feel like they've been through like 20, 30 hands. You know,
or rarely... not enough too, right?
Potentially, like the bigger ones for people who do have the power to kind of like, you know, be edited less. But like there's a sense that there's not a word out of place. There's never even like a word you have to look up in the dictionary or anything. Like, you know, there's, you know, at least that's in literary fiction. I only review literary fiction. So that's kind of my sense that, you know, it is, you know, the Big Fives are Hollywood, and there's Hollywood films, and there's Age of Ultron, and there's a Little Miss Sunshine.
So, and even you said earlier with the cover input, because that's something really authors do not. Even in my job, and we're a small press, it's 20 of us.
Right.
I mean, editorial and marketing will force the hand pretty much.
Yeah.
But and then at a certain point, we don't care. We've done 20 rounds. Give them whatever they want. So my advice would be wear them down.
Certain presses. Yeah, I mean, if I think as an author, you should voice, you know, displeasure, and I'm sure you've experienced authors experience. You know, voicing displeasure at cover comps and stuff like that.
And not wanting to ethnicize it, too, because when I spoke to Mira, when I spoke to Sophia, the emphasis was she wanted a black girl on her cover. And so she hired an illustrator. She's self-publishing. Yeah. Yeah. Mira, who published with Random House, was very specific and said, I don't want saris, I don't want this. Yep. You know, it's an American story, not an Indian story.
Absolutely.
And so also I noticed, I mean, the difference with Sophia's is hers is for a younger audience, so she wants them to see the character.
Yeah.
But with yours and Mira's, it's very much architectural.
Yep.
It's a very clean aesthetic, and yours is symbolic more than, I mean, Mira's is symbolic too, but hers is giving more of the environment.
Right.
And yours is kind of like, it really does wed through the train tracks throughout the novel.
Right.
So was that also a purposeful choice of, I don't want.
Yes. Yes. There were some options.
Chinese American family on the cover.
Yeah, exactly.
At all.
There were a couple of options. I posted all the comps on my Facebook account, which is public. So if you were curious to take a look at them, you could see. But there were a couple of comps. There was one with actually like a young Asian man's face, kind of disaffected Asian man's face on it. And then there was another one that was kind of like, it looked like it was black and green, or black and yellow, and it kind of looked like an Amy Tan novel. Or it looked like kind of a 70s, kind of like a, you know, I don't know, Asian feel to it. With dragons, kind of like.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. You don't mention dragons.
Just parts of dragons.
Why? There are no dragons in this book.
I personally am a year of the dragon. I didn't mind it that much. You know, perfectly pretty covers.
But do you feel like they were a little stereotypical in the assumption of...
I think we went with the cover we went with for the reason of avoiding the ethnic, you know, identification. I mean, as a writer, you know, it's actually very important to me to be seen as a writer and not an Asian American writer. You know, just like it was important for, say, like one of my idols, Saul Bellow, you know, to be, he was very important for him in his life to be identified as an American writer and not a Jewish American writer, you know, not an Isaac Singer type writer. And I feel the same way about, you know, my ethnicity is that, you know, if it were up to me, that there would be no ethnicity at all mentioned ever. You know, it wouldn't even say Chinese American on the book flap.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think ideally, you know, I would like to be telling stories where about, you know, Chinese American characters where the ethnicity is not like super important, to the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of that, can we talk a little bit about Solver Palm?
Sure.
I mean, I don't know if you want to give a, can you give an elevator pitch of it?
Well, sure.
Because I couldn't truncate it the way
you did. Yeah.
Sullivan's jacked up.
Yeah. It's a black comedy about a dysfunctional Chinese American family, the family of the Pongs. And they've also had multiple generations of the Pong family have been in America and have been kind of notorious for being F-ups and fuck-ups. Can we swear?
Yeah.
Can we start on the podcast? Fuck-ups. Yeah. and the main character, Sulliver, has moved away out of his hometown of Border Town, which is misspelled because it was a town started by Chinese people. He's moved away and into Copenhagen. He's married a Danish wife. He's thinking he's out. He's out of this family, this toxic family, toxic hometown, American hometown situation. Mm-hmm. And then he's sort of manipulated back into the fold by his father, who is the mayor of the town. Mm. So, and then, you know,
hijinks ensues,
and eventually Sully kind of runs for mayor against his father out of spite, essentially. And then more hijinks ensues. There's a lot of hijinks.
A lot of hijinks. And when you're touching on the whole, I want to be seen as an American writer, not as a Chinese American writer, I got the sense of, I mean, I relate to it too. I'm an African American, but I really do consider myself American.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm Black American, but I'm just like, we're so assimilated to American culture that for us, it's just like, what else is there?
Right.
And that's what I definitely got in the sense of the book.
Mm-hmm.
With Sulliver, but you know, at the same time, he doesn't know where he's coming from.
Right.
But it's not because of a whole, I don't know who I am. Am I Chinese? Am I white? Am I American? It's really like, am I a douchebag?
Yeah. am I a good person or am I a bad person?
Yeah. And I appreciated that aspect of the book because it isn't, you know, the word diversity is thrown around as a buzzword for some. And people would say this is a diverse book because it has ethnic characters in it. But the fact of the matter is it really is in line with contemporary American literature.
Right.
In terms of the parent dynamic, you know, there's constantly the, oh, I have either issues with my mom or my dad or both.
Right.
Who am I? Am I happy? Midlife crisis.
Yeah.
Doing really stupid things.
Yes.
A lot of stupid things. Yeah, sometimes you're just like, man, Sulliver, really? Like, dude, just stay home.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Stay home.
But to those, to me as an author, they were funny, stupid things. You know?
Yeah.
It depends where you are as a reader. You know?
And also their characters. And, you know. Politicians can be corrupt. That's not exactly fictional.
Yeah.
But yeah, going back to the whole representation. So when you think about breaking into the industry, do you still think people aren't looking at it as an American family story because the main characters are Chinese American?
When we went through the process of submitting, the book, that the ethnicity aspect of it did not really come up. Mm-hmm. It was more the, you know, the protagonist or the characters being kind of somewhat despicable.
Oh, don't tell me they asked if they wanted to be likable.
There was a little bit of that. The most common refrain of the nice rejections were, you know, that just didn't fully connect with the characters, which is like, you know, a very amorphous piece of feedback.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of just taste stuff, but you know, as what I wanted out of the book was to entertain, to make people laugh. I didn't want it to be an identity book novel. I'm actually working on a novel now that's much more identity based.
Mm-hmm. Well, even though the two pieces you wrote about in your essay, I mean, one you said was autobiographical, more for young readers, and then the next one was someone who was dying, and then those parallels. Those didn't seem multicultural in terms of, they didn't sound like what you were describing.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. It's just never been a huge, like, I've only, to be honest, I've only started reading more diversely in recent years. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that has to do with, you know,
what we're taught in schools.
Yeah, what we're taught in schools, even in graduate programs. Oh, you know, the mentors will give you their list of their grades, and, you know, it'll be of a certain, you know, ethnicity. It'll probably be mostly white. And
European.
Lots of Europeans. Yeah, exactly. And personally, like, when I was coming up, you know, my heroes were Saul Bellow, Martin Amis, you know, white guys. Essentially, you know, the comedy of Martin Amis and Kingsley Amis. And I mean, I love Murakami as well. But not, I wasn't looking to, you know, say Asian Am lit writers as my heroes. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing or just a thing, you know.
I feel like it is a thing with American culture, because I didn't start reading till I left grad school. Diversely as well, unless I took that course. You know, like, oh, I'm taking the African-American lit course.
So a lot of the submission process happened around 2010. So, like, the, I think we were full on in sort of the haze of a post-racial America. Remember that?
Yeah, because Obama.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks, Obama.
Remember that?
And another recession.
Yeah, exactly.
Post-racial, and people are losing their houses.
Now it's interesting. It's such, it's really in the last year, and obviously you're doing a podcast about it. The consciousness has raised so much, and
it's constant.
Yeah, it's constant. A constant refrain. I think it's an important refrain. I hope it lasts. You know, if I have any reservations that it won't last, or there'll be it'll be more of a fad, and I felt like that if. Like, the film literature analogs, I think, are not, don't apply, but it felt like we were having this diversity conversation about the Oscars, like, a few years ago, and then
it happens again, and people are like, it's still happening.
Yeah.
You remember that time in the 90s and 80s when there were no people of color nominated too, and we just didn't have the internet to complain about it? Yeah. But in the terms of this discussion continuing forward, is the hope, and a lot of people do say the hope is that we won't, and I don't know if segment, maybe it is segmenting, it's just like continue to segment diverse books as diverse.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I got a diverse book for you. You know? You're like, okay. Someone doesn't come and say, you should read Leland Shuck.
Yeah.
Because he's Asian American, you should read Leland Chuck because he has a good way of doing dialogue in tense situations.
He's funny, I hope.
Yeah,
I ultimately think that, you know, any sort of like segmentation or like, you know, marketing sort of books by writers of color towards readers of color, I have to say, I think it might be a losing game.
You think?
In the end.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I think we all have to graduate, you know, and kind of, unfortunately, you know, and I worked in marketing, so I know this, like, you assume that, you know, certain things about market segments that are probably not true and not even data-driven at all. It's just sort of like a best stab.
Yeah. Or it's how we've always thought.
Right.
So why would we stop now?
I think, you know, as a writer, you know, as an author, I hope to write books that are, you know, beyond, that are universal in nature, and race will probably play a part of it because it's inescapable. But I'm not sure, what is it? Was it Maya Angelou? Was that Maya Angelou or Toni Morrison said that black, you know, literature tends to be read as sociology as opposed to, you know,
entertainment,
as opposed to literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty astute. And I think, you know, I think readers are finding reasons. Readers, when they go to the bookstore, are looking for, you know, reasons to say no to every book. There's a zillion books on a table, right? Yeah, how do you pick them? Yeah. You know, maybe I don't feel like reading about Asian Americans today. You know,
yeah.
that you know, that's a reason to say no. You know, so I think we got to get to some point, some level of universality, you know, mm-hmm. with stories. I hope, you know, in the future. You know, I've been obviously been a writer for 17, 18 years or whatever, mm-hmm. And I thought we'd be further along than this by now.
You'd think.
Yeah.
You'd think.
Yep. Yep.
So getting to your essay, which is very intense in terms of
what's happening. The last 2 years have been intense.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And in the midst of all this, you hear that your book is going to be published.
Right. Right.
And it's interesting because you talk about legacy also.
Yes.
Like, if something happens, my book, and this was prior to hearing from Chicago Center for Literature and Photography about the acceptance, was what will be there to represent all this work I did as an artist.
Right.
So did you consider self-publishing? Also?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, I was following the breadcrumbs. I think, you know, like in life, you just follow the breadcrumbs of your life and see where it goes. And, mm-hmm. you know, I had been, you know, last 5 years, as I felt like my writing was starting to emerge, you know, mm-hmm. and starting to, like, publish a little bit.
You go to McDowell and they have great food.
they have great food and the views are great. I still have no idea how I got in. But, would love to go back again, you know, sometime before I die. But, you know, for listeners who may have not have read the essay that is coming out soon when it's recorded, but mm-hmm. I was diagnosed with MDS, myelodysplastic syndrome. It's basically a blood cancer and a bone marrow failure disease, and I needed a stem cell transplant to live. You know, I was probably within months, if lucky, a couple of years of dying, and was lucky enough to get that transplant, and stem cell transplants are probably the toughest thing that you can do to your body. At least that's what the nurses told me. And so the first 1 year survival rates of stem cell transplants from unrelated donors is 62% in the U.S.
Oh, 62.
Yeah.
Has it gone down? Because it was 65 in here.
It's 62 nationwide. That particular, you know, Dr. Castro, my doctor,
he had a
65% mm-hmm. Hit rate, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm 18 months out, and knock on wood, I'm still doing well.
Yay.
Yeah.
And you went through, you go through a lot in that process. It can only be imagined, and it's described pretty vividly, but also a little removed to not completely maybe drown out the reader, because we still want to connect to the angle of how important writing is and how important the work is in that instance as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I definitely tried to, you know, keep the stem cell transplant specifics kind of accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also lucky in that I was young. I mean, I'm 39 now. I was 37 when I got the transplant. But in that the symptoms didn't hit me as hard. And I think if you want to read about how hard it hits you, you can read Robin Roberts did blog posts for Good Morning America. I don't know if she does Good Morning America still.
She does.
Does she? Mm-hmm. Okay. But she had the same disease, the same transplant. Mm-hmm. Docs gave her a 30 to 40% chance of surviving because she's older than I am. I think she's in her 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she said she felt like she was dying. You know, she couldn't eat and all that stuff. But I was lucky in that I felt about 70%,
mm-hmm.
which is probably a total illusion, which, you know, is part of what the essay is about, is how disconnected your mind is from your body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I felt generally okay. My wife tells me I was a decent patient. I was a nice guy. I was a nice guy throughout for the most part, mm-hmm. and got out relatively early. Got out in 3.5 weeks, but mm-hmm. it's just weird being in perfect health, you know, and and I had just traveled overseas with my wife. You know, my wife had got some international assignments. We had just been to places like Cambodia and like in Southeast Asia and all these like places that would Malaysia and, you know, all these places that you would think would ravage a person with a depleted immune system like my own at the time. But I was lucky, you know, and got through it, and then I came back and got diagnosed. It was crazy. And then I spent 2 months, probably close to 2 months in 2015 in the hospital for various treatments. So.
And 2015 is when Sulliver came out.
Yes.
So how was that process considering everything you were going through? Because that's a very different way to look at it too, where you, when you got the news, you were still going through treatment.
Right.
So was it, hold on guys, you know, a little busy. Get back to you in a few months.
I immediately emailed some friends that are writers and kind of like asked them what I should do. I didn't accept right away.
Were you thinking of not accepting at all to get everything done and then revisit?
It's an indie press, so as a writer, you're just like conditioned, especially if you've been in the game for a long time, to continue hoping that, you know, you can get a bigger press out interested in it. So you know, given my situation, I was in a hospital bed, you know, going through the transplant, and I was like, I think it's just time to, I wrote my friends, I was like, I, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think it's time to put out a book. and ultimately that's what we did, but you know, and then I got home and then I talked to, you know, the publisher over the phone, and even then I was pretty weak, you know, bald after the chemo, and you know, my wife, who's 8 inches shorter than I am, was beating me down the street. She's always complaining about how I walk too fast, you know, and I'm doing the New York fast step. But when I got home, I couldn't beat somebody 5 foot tall, you know, down the street. So it was a crazy experience that is still going on, and I'm just hoping for the best.
Same here. I'm really glad you're still here.
Yeah, I'm glad. Trust me, I'm glad I'm still here too.
I also spoke with Mira Jacob, author of The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing. And as mentioned, she is currently writing and illustrating an upcoming graphic novel memoir called Good Talk. And her debut, The Sleepwalker's Guide, was published with Random House in 2014. She's also the founder of the Pete's Reading Series, which is very big here in New York City, Brooklyn specifically.
So in the midst of doing all of everything you were doing and handling it since the inception of Pete's, how did your debut come about? Was it a very long process for you in terms of The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing? Was that just that tome that took forever, or was it something that really kind of came to fruition pretty quickly? And I hate to use the word quick when it comes to writing, but yeah, you know, kind of in retrospect.
Oh no, I mean, yes, that's just a quantitative way to describe something. Yes, I mean, quickly, we all know when we're writing quickly, and there's no, unfortunately, qualitative difference I've realized between things that take me a long time to write and things that just come right out. And to answer your question, I was writing The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing for 10 years, between the hours of 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. I worked in corporate America. I supported my family. I had a lot of big things that I was doing otherwise in those years, because I was in my 20s and 30s and trying to kind of keep myself afloat in the city. And I was running Pete's as my kind of labor of love, because I loved literature and because I cared about it. But when I first moved to New York to become a writer, the kind of writing that was in vogue at that particular moment was writing by, just to like describe it to you, it was sort of writing by white men in which not a lot of things happened.
Oh yeah.
You remember that? Okay. And the crazy thing was about that writing was, because I would read it and I would think, why was this published? Okay, there's some secret thing in here. What is the thing? And then in comparison, everything that I had to write about, which was race politics and being you know, very uncomfortable in, you know, my skin, and characters who were battling up against some huge identity problems seemed really, really gaudy. I don't have another word to describe. It just felt like, wow, that's a lot of emotion. Because these were real things that were happening around me, but somehow it felt too obvious. Now when I look back on it, it makes me laugh because what was, and I think also, to be honest, I think that people sort of said that to me over and over again when they would read my work. I remember having a professor who said, you know, it's great that you write about these things, but, you know, you're such a great writer. Don't ghettoize yourself about always writing about ethnicity.
Ooh.
Yeah. Which was really funny because another way to say that was, and I don't think she would have thought she was saying this to me, but another way to say that was, don't lower yourself by writing about yourself.
That's how I took it.
Yeah, that's the way I took it. That's the way I took it, which is don't discuss these things, which, you know, which are just sort of lower class things to talk about, not really worthy of intellectual discussion. Meanwhile, the stories of white men doing nothing were somehow worth it all. But anyway, this is just to say, like, when I came here, it was that. And those were the stories that I was trying to, and when you come from the outside, you try to decode. So I was trying to decode those stories to see what I could do to my own. And I couldn't do much. And when I was writing my book over those 10 years, I didn't have a single short story that went out or went anywhere. I had zero reason to believe the book would ever be published. There was not a lot going on in the industry, except an occasional, here's the Indian writer of the, you know, year who we love.
I mean, Jhumpa Lahiri is basically thrown around. She's kind of, for, I feel like, at least the Indian literary scene, she is kind of like what Sherman Alexie is, because, you know, he's the only writer of that ethnicity people can name.
Absolutely.
Literally.
Absolutely.
All I can think of is Sherman Alexie. All I can think of is Jhumpa Lahiri. And there's just like, that's, well, I'm very happy you came on the scene.
Well, you know what's funny is, and I've talked about this a lot, is that there was a whole funny thing that happened when I came on the scene, which is that people said, well, her writing, you know, it will be compared to Jhumpa Lahiri's, and here's how that works. Here's where we find her in that comparison. And then the next thing said, you know, her writing has been compared to Jhumpa Lahiri's, but Jacob does blah, 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 something else. And then another one said, well, she's no Jhumpa Lahiri, which was just cracking me up reading it, because I thought, y'all are talking to yourselves. I'm not trying to be, like, I know this may be shocking to everybody, but I would never even begin to compare my writing to Jhumpa Lahiri's, because we almost have nothing to do with each other. And people hear that and they think, well, what are you talking about? You're both Indian, not realizing that there are so many kinds of Indians, and we are in such different Indias. We come from such different Indias, and we came to such different Americas.
And that your inspiration can be so different, too.
Of course.
In terms of female and male writers as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I guess what happened was I'd been working on this book for 10 years, and in the middle of it, I stopped writing for a few years, partially because the events in my life were sort of mimicked by the book. I had a father that I had decided was going to die very early on while I was writing the book, and then my actual father started dying in real life, and I just stopped writing. So that's an eerie thing to have happen. But then what happened was I was writing, and I was, as I told you, sort of failing upwardly in the corporate world, and I went into a meeting at a time when you were really dependent on my paycheck, thinking I was going into a normal meeting, and instead I was told that I was being replaced by 5 social media interns. And my life kind of very quickly imploded that day. And I remember, because I went and I talked to my husband about what had just happened, and I said, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I just got laid off, and I don't know what this means for us. And I think that happens to people the world over, and they know what a kind of sideswipe that is for your ego. But the good part about it is I had been trying for years to finish this book between 11 and 1. I had a kid and I had a lot of other things that I was juggling. And it was the first time when we both agreed that I just needed to finish the book and do whatever it took to finish the book. So the last quarter of the book was written in 2 months as I was running out of money. And the the crazy thing about it was when I finished it, my agent said, well, go do something with your life because you've written a really long book. No one's going to get back to you right away. You know, and she was really great about it. She was the one who, when I was laid off, called me and said, finish the book. It's going to change your life. So I went to do something with my life, and we heard back very quickly. And we heard back from quite a few people. And that was a really surprising moment for me. It was surprising because I had not seen stories, many stories like mine, and because I had been around the industry enough to know how few times that would ever happen, and because people seemed to relate to the story in the exact way I had hoped. And that was really, it was a great moment. It was a great moment for somebody who had never actually managed to get anything published but had been working quietly for years. It was an out-of-body experience. Now, that said, so I am totally clear on that, and I'm also clear on the fact that the house that I work with, which is Random House, they were great. We talked early on about the things that I was afraid of for the book, and I said, please do not Sorry and Spices the cover. I'll die. this is an American story, and it needs to, I need you to understand that. And they got that, and as stuff came up, they were thoughtful, and we went through this process, and I did have to raise things. You know, I did have to raise issues, and they did make me uncomfortable bringing things up in the way that I would have to say certain things. But I also felt like the best thing that could happen did happen for me, and I'm aware of this because my corporate life was nowhere near as clear, which is that I had people who were open to what I was saying. They didn't automatically shut me down, and that... And sometimes we didn't agree, and sometimes I would settle for, there would be a compromise that wasn't, exactly ideal. However, the best thing that can happen in that situation for a person like me is to know that I am being heard and to go through the process of trying to make things the way that I want them to. The thing I hate most, and the thing I think happens most often, is people say, yeah, sure, and they do. And they basically what they're worried about is being called racist, and they stop thinking and they hand you whatever it is that they think is going to satisfy you. And it's very weird. It's a very weird dynamic because you are not satisfied and the conversation is not thoughtful, and everybody feels like they are skating on thin ice, and it's ugly. And that actually didn't happen to me in this situation. And I'm really clear about that because so many ugly things have happened to myself and other writers, and I don't want to misrepresent this particular thing. That said, when I went out with the book, and I was marketing it and I was going around the country with it and going into different, you know, bookstores and having different interviews and talking to the media, it was rough going sometimes. It was really hard always to start from a really limited perspective. I felt so many times that people were asking me questions that came from the assumption that nobody would possibly understand where I was coming from. So let us help you explain yourself. Mm-hmm. And in those moments, I wanted to stop the interview and say, do you know how many of me there are out there? Do you know how many of us have read the stories of your world and the assumptions you have made in those stories, and how many of us have made those imaginative bridges to understand what you are talking about, because that is the work of a reader, and yet you are talking as though readers could never do the same for me? Do you know how exhausting this is to know that you think this world is built for you and not me, and you don't see how many me's there are? So that was, you know, when I would come back and I would be exhausted, and I would talk to my writer friends about it, and live to fight another day. What do you do about this? How do you break in? How do you kind of keep your head up, and how do you keep moving forward with the truth, which is hard when you want to scream, you know? How do you keep moving forward with the part of you that stays engaged in a smart way and doesn't take everybody's knees out? And some days that was easier than others. And so, yeah. So anyway, that's how that went for me. I'm sorry, I'm rambling a little bit.
Oh, no. Well, it's so interesting that you said you were listened to. And what we were talking about earlier in terms of people just not even knowing what questions to ask or what to look for. What did you know what to look for when you heard back quickly?
Oh, yeah.
In terms of the response.
Yeah, absolutely. This is great. That's a great question because a very specific thing happened. One thing is, there's a lot going on in my book. It is the story of an immigrant family from India in New Mexico dealing with a lot of very sad and harrowing things, but there are many different angles in it. One of it is talking about the reception of East Indians versus what was happening to Native Americans in the country at the time, both of whom were called Indians, and the kind of disenfranchisement that different cultures experience. And there was just a lot, right? And there's narcolepsy, and there's a love story. There's all sorts of things happening. And what I was most terrified of was somebody coming in and saying exactly what happened in one meeting, which is, this story is just about way too much. And that happened in one meeting where an editor we were meeting with said, listen, you can tell the immigrant story, you can tell a love story, you can tell a political story, but you really tried to do all of those things in here, and it's just a bit much. And of course, I wanted to throw every writer from, like, you know, Fitzgerald to Portnoy at her, saying, really? Is that too much? Is it too much? But I kind of said, well, what's too much? Tell me what's too much. And she said, well, you know, people are going to read this and you've kind of got to let them live with, you know, one story, and you're just making things a bit too complex. And you know, one of these stories really needs to rise above the others. And I said, and in your opinion, which is that story? And she said, well, clearly the immigrant story. I think that's something that people really need to hear. And I kicked my agent under the table at that moment. And here's what happened. So I kicked my agent under the table, and I knew the conversation was kind of done. And we walked out, and I said, we cannot do this. I cannot have this person be in charge of the book, because this person wants the same story that this person has already read, and this person thinks is a safe bet, and I can't have that person be in charge of the story. And I said that to her, and she said, yeah, I get it. Well, you know, yep, you're absolutely right. I agree with you, and let's go on to the next person. But here's the thing. I had a next person to go on to. And what I thought about in that moment was how many people had been in my situation who hadn't had another person to go to, and whose only way of getting something published was to compromise their story significantly.
Yeah.
And give someone the story, give that editor the story that she wanted, which was a story that makes us so much smaller. And just so much less of who we can be. And I was so relieved in that moment that I had someone else to go to, but I was heartbroken because I thought of how many other people must have gone before me, right? Because we're all built on generations, and we're all like, you know, we all know how progress happens, and it means that for every door that you've gone through, there are a million others of us who have gotten stopped. And I realized in that moment, I felt grateful. Really grateful, but also I felt what it would have been to have to live with that person in charge of my story, and it was devastating.
What are some of the other realities that you had, that you experienced, that you weren't prepared for, or you were kind of hedging in terms of, beyond like these meetings where cringeworthy things are being said, but in terms of touring, I think the idea of touring, I should call it, is something. Yeah. New authors think, oh, yes, I'll get a tour. My publisher will send me everywhere. And that's really not realistic.
No.
Having one publicist do 60 books at a time.
Sure. So, yeah. So I was with a big five publisher, and I was sent to two places on tour. The rest of it was me. I mean, that was one thing that I was also surprised by. I thought, oh, you know, you bought the book. Surely you're going to want to send me out. No, that's not really what they do anymore. And I've been told the business reasons behind this, and the business reasons actually do make some sense. But I also knew that I was the only person who was going to be able to really sell this book. You know, I like to read and I like to connect with audiences. So I just went ahead and made that decision, knowing, and I set aside money for it. And again, I was in the position because of my life having worked in corporate America where I knew this was coming down the pike, and I was able to do that. to say, okay, I'm going to have to save some money for travel. And that was really lucky, right? That was lucky. The crazier part of that was that was that touring itself is can be really soul-wrecking for a writer of color. You're in these, I'm in Brooklyn. I'm in this nice little intellectual enclave. And when I leave Brooklyn and when I go to other places, the exotification factor is high. The thing that people love to say to me most often is, your book makes me so hungry. Let's talk about food. you know, just stuff that I get it. I do talk about food in my book because Indians are built of food, but that's really you want to talk about that and not the kind of the mental end of a young boy that can't find a place for himself in America. You want to talk about the food? Okay. We're talking about the food. And that's, you know, I get it. And I hope, you know, I'm kind of making light of it now. I love that any part of the book people can connect to, but when you're out and you're answering these questions or some of them or most of them are, and I just think your command of the English language is so wonderful. These things that are meant to be compliments that like make you just want to break the stage and leave. Those were hard moments. And I had to call people at night and say, talk to me like I have been an American for as long as I have. Talk to me like I am as entitled to this country as anyone else is, because this process of going on tour, people expected me to be grateful. Yeah. And I was grateful that my book was out. I was grateful that the story was in the world, but I don't think I need to be grateful for just being allowed to be at the table.
Mm-hmm.
Because no one allowed me to be at the table, by the way. I fought to be at the table.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's funny. And actually, when I put the speech out about race, I had done the speech for Publishers Weekly, and I published it online, the BuzzFeed piece. And by and large, the reaction to that was fantastic. I mean, it was very reassuring in the way that I knew that there were so many of us that felt this way. And then mm-hmm. I heard from those people. And that was about the most reassuring thing that could happen, was all of us that have been sort of that where people say to you, you know, sort of kind of imply like you're really kind of alone out there. And then all of a sudden I was like, no, I'm not. Nope. No, there are a lot of us. And that was really great. That was a great moment. But there was one reaction from someone in the industry who said, you know, this is an industry who's tried to celebrate you. You know, I really feel like you've kind of acted badly. And the implication being, you know, like this is an industry that's tried to celebrate you. And I feel like you've just really done us some harm. And the person that thinks that is a person who also must, I can only assume, think that there's some like universal HR I can go to when complete crap happens and say, hey man, I kind of got a bad shake this round. Can you change things for me? Cause the whole white power thing is kind of getting me down. Can you shut that?
Can you give them a warning on that?
Exactly. Can we give them, is there like a yellow card? Anyway, it was one of those things where I read it and I thought, oh, wow, the things that you have never had to deal with, the things that you don't even occur to you. There is no answer to this. I think that the person that wrote this was offended that I aired it. I think this is what she said, that you aired this so publicly. And I just thought, wow, you are a person for whom not airing things publicly has worked. Congratulations. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. We're not in that place.
No. And in terms of, you're very vocal about it, which is what I've always appreciated about your writing, not just your literary writing, but in terms of your more nonfiction essays, articles, just talking about the reality of it. And this weekend, it's funny, because sometimes activism or artivism, you know, being an artist and an activist, can be lonely, and people are fearful of actually saying their truth. And I've been in online communities where I'm the one saying, this is not okay, we're being silenced,
And people, like you said, they support you or they'll contact you directly, but they're afraid of doing that publicly. And I think there's some debuts or writers right now who feel this way, but they're afraid to say it. And even established writers as well, they're afraid to say these things, but they do agree with you. What do you think that fear comes from?
It's from a completely rational place. It's from a place of having gotten shut out before or having doors closed because you're viewed as irrational or hard to work with, because what you're saying generates discomfort. And I think people often mistake discomfort for disagreeability, right? They think that discomfort is rooted in some kind of irrational malevolence. If they're feeling discomfort, the other person must have either some sort of irrational or malevolent intent. And I think it's very hard for people who are made uncomfortable to, and when they're confronted with these things, to think like, okay, I'm deeply uncomfortable and my back is up and this person might have a point. It's very hard. And that's, and, but again, like I say that it's very hard, but a lot of us have been doing that our whole lives. So is it that hard? Is it that hard when you are offended to like get a hold of yourself and say, what are you trying to say? And like, how can I move ahead with you? How can we make this something where maybe both of us don't get exactly what we want, but we keep talking? Like, no, because the rest of us do that all the time. Honestly. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you when I say it like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
But I don't know if, you know, fear is the right word, because there is kind of a tenseness that comes when you're about to speak your truth. And you don't know what the reaction is going to be. And sometimes you're like, well, I'm just going to say it and see how this pans out. And just, it is what it is.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the fact that speech, the BuzzFeed speech went viral was very surprising to me. I thought that there would be, the reason I put it out is because when I was leaving that night, when I was leaving the room, there were like people of color just coming up to me and squeezing my arm, and they looked wrecked too. A few who had heard me, and they just looked, I thought that I was doing us a solid. I thought I was saying something that was like sort of obvious, you know, just like, this is pretty obvious, but I'm just going to put all the words together in one place so you guys can hear them. It was not like revolutionary to me what I was saying, and just the fact that no one heard it was painful. But the worst part of it was seeing the faces of the people of color when I was walking out of the room, who just sort of looked more wrecked because they were like, oh my God, this thing just happened. So I put it out, and I was surprised by the reaction to it, for sure. And that was a good surprise. And I've had many not good surprises, right? I've had many, and not actually, and more in my corporate life, but more with white bosses being surprised when I asked for money, you know, like that kind of thing. Like, wait, you think you also deserve a raise? Wait, what? And this kind of this sort of inherent understanding of like, but we're giving you a lot just by bringing you on, which was frankly much more prevalent in the 90s, but still was going on in the 2000s, you know, just this, and I know still goes on today. And there is no outlet to talk about. Like, you can go to HR with that, but HR is basically looking at ways to contain you so that you don't cause a scandal. And that's when it gets really scary. So this is just to say, I understand where that fear comes from, and I don't think it's an irrational fear. However, one of the things that I try to keep in mind is that if I am feeling this, then there have to be other people who are feeling it too. And I will tell you this as well, is that one of the things that happened, because I was working on my book so long, but when it sold as it did, when it was bought by a big five publisher, I remember feeling both blessed and also like, then that's a level of responsibility, right? Because if you're in that position, if you get into that position, if you're one of the few people that gets into that position, then you've got to stay kind of vigilant and be able to say things that are hard. And so, I mean, I feel like that's part of the, you know, whatever that is, I feel like that's part of the job, is if you're in that place, that's what you do with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's hard. I mean, I'm not saying that's everybody's responsibility, But that for me felt like part of mine was, mm-hmm. okay, but I'm one of the lucky ones, right? I'm one of the mm-hmm. quote unquote lucky ones. So if I'm one of the lucky ones and I'm seeing this, then part of my job is to say what I see. And yeah, does that make for some rough conversations? Absolutely.
A lot, I imagine.
For sure. And, you know, but also I will say, like, yes, it makes for some rough conversations. Yes, that is true. But I said that thing that was scary for me to say, and then I put it out on the internet, and my publisher has not been scared of me. We've had some very intense conversations, mm-hmm. but they have not. And I'm not saying that is true the world over for people at all. I'm just saying that is one option sometimes. Sometimes you can say the thing that scares the shit out of you to say, mm-hmm. and you say it, and someone will actually listen, and the conversations will be loaded and they will be scary, mm-hmm. but you can move ahead. That's not what happens all the time. I'm not an idiot. I don't think that that happens for everybody, but I do feel like it's important for people to know that that is one option. That is one option. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can speak your truth and have it heard.